All right. Well, we are kicking off the second live stream. I'm very, very excited about today's guest. Neil Tovsin, welcome to the live stream. How are you this fine morning? Morning for us.
Fantastic, fantastic. It's a beautiful, sunny, warm day in Minneapolis.
I'm going to laugh about that a little bit. And for anyone who is listening, we are chuckling a little because I used to live in Minnesota and he said it's a beautiful, warm 28 degrees Fahrenheit there. And meanwhile, I'm over here in Texas, like, it's going to be 78 today. I'm going to work outside this afternoon. Oh, how the weather is different.
Yeah, a little bit different perspective on that one.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I am so excited to have you today. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? Obviously, from Minnesota. We'll get into kind of like what you do and how you build, but just generally sort of like what you've been up to and who are you?
Sure. So I started my career years ago in large enterprise. Companies like GE and Siemens and PricewaterhouseCoopers, stuff like that, and I kind of got this sort of itch to do my own thing, and so I've founded two startups, and then got to a point where I couldn't really sustain that after 6 years and wanted to start a family. So I kind of, like, out of necessity, and before the word fractional, like, it was hard to explain what I did, but I kind of stumbled into this sort of fractional CTO sort of thing. And I've been doing that. I did that full time for about 5 years and getting back into it now after a little sabbatical. So I love working with startups. I love working with non-technical founders. I love coaching technical founders that maybe are new to the startup world, or maybe you're a, you know, my first client was actually a technical co-founder, but they were fresh out of school. And so they had a brilliant idea. They managed to raise money very quickly, had a big first customer right away, and said, "Oh gosh, now what do we do?" It was kind of more of a coaching, player coach sort of scenario there. But yeah, generally speaking, people who can't afford, or don't need a full-time technical co-founder.
Oh my gosh, I love that so much. We nerded out on this a little bit before we actually started the live stream, but I think that's something that's really needed right now. And honestly, there's a lot of fractional types of roles. And not to go on a tangent too much, but I started doing fractional DevRel earlier in the year as I was starting to build my business. I thought maybe that was the thing I wanted to chase down. Turns out I don't by any means. But I had to explain what fractional meant, and I thought that was kind of interesting. So I do agree that it's not as known. Do you want to maybe give folks a good idea? I think you sort of did in your description, but maybe just let them know what fractional means to you.
I think the hardest thing for me, 10 years ago when I started doing this kind of work, was trying to explain to people the difference between, like, a consultant and a fractional, right? A fractional is just simply not full time. That's all it means, really, right?
Yeah, that's true.
So if I'm the CTO, I'm the CTO. I just might be working for multiple companies because they're part time, right? And I think that's the key difference, is that I'm part of your team. I'm there with you in the trenches. I'm not a consultant. I'm not, whatever. I do coaching engagements, which is more consulting sort of stuff too, for high performing software engineering and product development. What do we build? How do we build it? How do we operate it? Sort of stuff. But the fractional side of things, if it's a fractional gig, like, I'm part of the team until such time as either I hire my full-time replacement, or you don't need me anymore. But it's basically an employee sort of arrangement, not just some sort of arm's length consulting sort of thing.
I agree, which is why I didn't want to do it.
Yep.
It's for, there's everything, everyone has their different roles. I think in a CTO space, I could see it would be really, really great opportunity. In a DevRel space, which already has a lot of sort of who's talking to who, is product talking to marketing, is marketing talking to sales? Do they know what's happening with DevRel and developer relations? And that's already sort of a political nightmare. And to come in part-time and try to chase down that nightmare is not as fun. But I think, in a CTO realm, I could see where that'd be a really beautiful, rewarding role.
Yeah. Like I said, it's really just about, I love rolling up my sleeves and being part of the team. And I love earlier stage companies because you get to play so many hats. You get to get involved in the business, which, I kind of believe that, every software engineer, you're with every line of code you write, you're placing bets on behalf of the business. And if you aren't, like, fully in tune with what the business is doing, even as a junior dev, like, as much as you can, learn about what the business is doing. And when I'm working with CEOs and senior leaders, like my advice to them is just spew your thoughts. Like, help the team understand how you think. Help the team understand, what do you want to be when you grow up? What is this company going to do? How do we approach all this stuff? Because the way that you're thinking about it influences the code people write, you know?
Yep.
And so if you're working, you know, like I said, even as a junior dev, the more you can understand about where we're going and why,
yep,
the better code you're going to write, you're going to make better decisions, you know?
Yep. And you're going to be more invested, right? I don't know about you, but for me, like when I hear someone's vision and it's like, okay, I'm thinking about this today, but here's where I'm going in 5 years or 2 years or whatever it looks like, I get excited. Like if I'm invested and I care about it, I get excited and I'm like, okay, you tell me how to get you there, right? Like, how do we do this together? So I fully agree. And I think I was just at a conference last week, which we were talking about how you had watched yesterday's live stream. So you heard about this, of actually a dev who was really like, I really think we're making bad decisions. And it was one of those scenarios. It's like, I don't think that enough developers find their way into those business conversations or are exposed to those business conversations to really start to understand that and apply that and bring that into their day-to-day, which I think is a missed opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. So like my favorite scenario, which is exactly kind of what you're talking about, is like you've got the typical situation, right, where, you know, you've got a CEO or a product leader or something like that who's like, oh, we got to go faster. We got to da, 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 da. And the software engineers are like, oh, but I have to make it perfect. I have to make it really good. I have to spend extra time. And it's like the answer is probably somewhere in between.
Yep.
But if everybody's invested in where we're going and why, then those conversations get a lot easier because the conversation becomes not about making this perfect software that's beautiful and that we like to look at 6 months from now, which almost never happens no matter how hard you try, really, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But it becomes, where are we going and why, and what's the best way to approach that? And so, yep, you know what? One of the things that I don't think I've ever figured out until I started my own business and start like, oh, that's why this matters, right? Is like, when do you take shortcuts?
Yes.
Right? I'm such a technical perfectionist.
Yes.
That I couldn't let myself take shortcuts. And I think early in my career, my managers got really frustrated at me for that, right? Because yes, I wanted to make it perfect. And they're like, no, just get it done. And I never understood because I didn't want to deal with that 2 years from now or whatever. And the reality is, if the company doesn't survive for 2 years, it does not matter what you have to deal with in 2 years, right?
Yes. So,
that was like, that was something, one of those, like, I wish somebody had taught me as a junior dev or figured out how to get through my thick skull as a junior dev of like, why sometimes it's okay. And even like, if you come into a scenario, you know, nerds, our favorite thing is to walk into the room and look at the code and be like, well, I didn't write it, so that's crap, right? And it's like, the reality
is judgy.
That code got us where we are.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And if, you know, so many businesses just don't survive, you know, my first startup, total failure. I went 3 years. I learned a ton, but that code's gone, right? Nobody's going to see that code again ever. And it doesn't matter how perfect it was. The business didn't survive. So if you're not making choices that are based on what the business needs right now, even if that means taking ugly, hacky shortcuts sometimes, intentionally understanding the impact, right? Placing the bet, then it doesn't matter.
Yep. Oh my gosh. What you said, I was just over here like, yes, yes, which you can obviously tell, but I started my business back in April. So it's been, you know, I don't know, however long that's been. It's been a hot minute. I have that problem. I have the, I need to reach perfection problem. And I couldn't figure out, and I've struggled with it my entire life as a dev also. I couldn't figure out. I'm like, oh, I just feel like I'm delivering such greatness. And my coach was like, hey, I get it, but you know, you're probably delivering too much, right? Like they're looking for, hey, I need insights on this event that's coming up. And they maybe want something that's a quick turnaround, right? Here's how you approach it. Here's who you go talk to. Here's your, you know, your whole focus. Here's the goal, right? Here's what you're going after. And instead I'm like, here's a 10-page strategy doc on how you're going to go to this event and how you're going to show up and who you should talk to and why. And it's like, they don't need all that, right? And I think as a dev, I constantly did the same thing. I was like, everything had to be perfect. It had to be pixel perfect, like literally pixel perfect, because I was more on the front end side. And it took longer. It took more time, but I felt better about that. And I think that that's great and all, but like you said, sometimes businesses don't survive. And sometimes you need all those strategic insights to be able to say, hey, I have this ticket. I know that this is something that's sort of small. This isn't necessarily a priority for us in the future. This is sort of a, maybe it's a patch, right? Whatever the situation is, to be able to say, hey, you know what? I can put my 75% in, my 80% in, right? It doesn't have to be at 100.
I would almost recharacterize that. It's not as though you're not putting 100% in. It's what you're optimizing for, right? I always put in 100%. Right? I'm always super passionate about what we're doing, right?
Yep.
But what am I optimizing for? Am I optimizing for speed? Am I optimizing for quality? Am I optimizing for UX? Am I optimizing for, you know, what is that, right?
Yep.
And that's the conversation. And so it's not about phoning it in. It's not about being, you can still be a perfectionist. This is kind of how I solve the puzzle in my brain, right? I'm a perfectionist. Ooh.
Yep.
I changed the definition of perfection to match the need at the time.
That's smart.
All it is, right?
Yes.
So, you know, and I still have trouble with it. I still like, I just can't let it go. And every now and then somebody will be like, dude, just commit. Like, okay. Or,
just commit.
That happened yesterday, actually. But like, you know, that's still a thing. But, but yeah, you have to change the definition of the objective. And again, that's why the business context matters. Because that helps you as your, you know, super anal perfectionist engineer mind square away the fact that I'm going to hack this and ship it, right?
Yep.
Because I'm shooting for perfection of a business. I want to get that next round of funding. I need to get to that release. I need to, because I understand why that's important, right?
I love that angle even more. You're still contributing your 100%. You're still feeling like you're reaching that perfectionist level that you want to be at, but you're focusing that energy in the right direction.
Exactly. And like I said, it didn't get through my skull until I actually owned my own business. But if there's like a way for other people to like somehow, you know, grok that in a way that doesn't require you to, you know, take all your life savings and put it in a trash can and light it on fire, then you'll be ahead of me.
We are so relatable right now. All right. Digressing from our dumpster fires, sure. Which are all great lessons for everyone to learn, right? We talked about, you know, what you do. Do you have an official title or company? Do you work for yourself? One of my questions
is independent. Yeah. And just, you know, fractional CTO and product development coach. Mm-hmm.
Love it. Well, we talked about earlier before we got on the live stream that you got to spend the last 6 months remodeling your house, which is a nice little break. So with that, what are you diving into these days?
So I'm working on I'm actually back working in a Ruby on Rails project with a client that I've worked with off and on for 10 years. It's really awesome. You know, I've worked in a lot of different languages and a lot of different frameworks. And they all, you know, they're all tools. They were all built by somebody to solve a problem. And so they all have utility and it's all different ways. But I got to say, you know, Ruby as a language is so elegant. Rails is so, you know, I love the idea of opinionated software. And I think Rails has done that as well or better than anybody else. And so is it the right tool for every job? Absolutely not. But I love it when I get to play with it.
Yeah. What do you feel like is the, so I don't have as much exposure to, you know, Ruby and Ruby on Rails generally. I know many devs who build with it and the ones that do just love it and they are like, they swear by it. And so I haven't had the chance to actually sit down and be like, why do you swear by it? So tell me like, what is it about sort of that stack that really just you feel like is so powerful, but more so, where do you feel like it plays the best role in what you're building? Because like you had said, it's not the job, it's not the tool for everything.
Honestly, the way that I think about it in my mind is that there's a dichotomy between Ruby the language and Rails the framework. So Ruby itself is like, it's you know, people compare it to Lisp, things like that. It's like this crazy, crazy expressive language, right? I feel like, and that's a double-edged sword a little bit. On one hand, I could probably take an RB file and I could hand it to my grandmother and she could probably read it and have a clue about what it does, because a good Ruby developer, it almost looks like natural language. Like Ruby itself, you don't need any, you know, people talk about creating DSLs for certain domain specific languages, things like that. Ruby just is that, right? You don't need that because the language itself is so expressive. On the flip side, when you're first starting out, I remember when I first started it, I found it was very hard to write because it's literally a blank page. Like it is so expressive that it's hard to understand. So Ruby itself has this crazy capability that's a little bit hard to wrap your brain around. And then you throw Rails on top of it, which is your web framework for, you know, APIs and web pages and database access and all this other stuff. And that's all crazy opinionated about how you do things, which is what saves your butt from Ruby's like openness. Like it's so hard to figure out what to do with Ruby sometimes because it's so expressive. Rails says, do it this way. That tension is amazing. Yep. Is amazing. And then the other piece about Ruby that's really interesting is that Ruby, being an interpreted language, has the ability to do things with like a lot of the best libraries and stuff. Active Record is their ORM, for example. Like you can have a class that is just class user, and that's the entire class. And if you go define the rows in the columns in the database table at runtime, it has all the getters and setters for all those attributes automatically, as well as all the persistence methods and all that other stuff. So Ruby has this ability to actually take a class and modify it at runtime. And that's a lot of how Rails works, which gives Rails a whole bunch of crazy capabilities that when I first started doing it, coming from languages like Java and .NET, things like that, I thought was insane and dangerous. But again, the Rails community is so opinionated on exactly how you use that power that's how it works. So it doesn't have a lot of safety nets in the language, but the community has built these crazy strong conventions that are really powerful. And it's a very different way of approaching problems from say Java, right?
Yeah.
And it has pros and cons. But man, when it works, it's beautiful. Like it's generally easier to if you have a experienced Ruby dev to show up on a new project and be productive the first day. I've personally done that. I've seen it. I've hired people who've done that. The conventions are so strong in that community that you can be productive almost immediately. Like walking into a Rails app is walking into any Rails app, by and large, right? And then you kind of get into my next favorite catchphrase, which is, I love tools that make easy things easy and make hard things possible. And I think Rails fits that well. Easy things are easy, hard things are possible, right?
Oh, that's great. Okay, so follow up to that. I'm so excited about Ruby, honestly. I'm like, So I have a future guest in a couple of weeks coming on. His name is Brian Castle, and he just launched this. Do you know who that is?
I know the name, yeah.
Okay, so he I don't know when he launched it. I met him at an event many years ago and have known him for a number of years, but he has like an app in a month kind of a vibe service where he's offering. And it's like, he'll come in and it's like on a weekly basis, he's contributing to the SaaS product that you want to try to build out, right? Can you get to where you want your app to be? And I just thought it was so interesting. And now that you told me about Ruby and like Rails and how they come together and the power there, makes tons of sense because that's what he's using. And that's what he just thinks that it is awesome. And he's not a dev by trade. He actually came in from sort of a different industry, but has been in SaaS and building these different things. And so now I'm like, oh, I can't wait to talk to Brian, because I think he'll have very similar sentiment, but also have sort of thoughts on what he's building and how that's coming into play. So follow up on that, where do you think that stack is the most lucrative for building, right? Like when would you choose to use that versus maybe something else?
That's such a hard question.
I figured.
Well, so I mean, here's the thing, like as much as I love it, the reality is that, you know, practitioners of Ruby and Rails have been generally, I think, in the decline. And so, you know, I think a lot of that has to do with talking with the founder about what they want to be when they grow up. What is the company going to be? and the culture that they want, right? So, you know, all of the different languages and frameworks each kind of carry their own culture, which on, you know, which on the good side is they bring their own superpowers and they vary by language. On the flip side, they bring their own baggage, right? And so the baggage in the Rails community is that the language does not seem to be growing, which is a bummer. And the practitioners, I would probably say the average Rails practitioner tends to be very, very highly skilled, very passionate about software engineering, and they tend to value productivity. Those are all great things. They also tend to be expensive. They tend to be hard to find, you know, things like that. And so it's all kind of a question of what's the right tool for what do you want to be? You're placing a bet again. Where do you want to be? You know, JavaScript developers, TypeScript developers are everywhere. And a lot of them are fantastic. And the tools are so ubiquitous that it's really hard to argue against picking something that has that kind of inertia and momentum, right? So, you know, you're making those kinds of conversations. But if you've got a case where, you know, you don't mind trying to find those rare, very highly sought after engineers, and you've got a business case that is compelling and interesting to that kind of culture, right? Then, you know, maybe that's the right choice for you, because you can build a culture that can innovate quickly and can do a lot of interesting things that maybe are harder to do, not impossible, but harder to do in other languages.
See, now I'm really turned on by it, because that would definitely be what, you know, I'm as I'm sure you can relate to, right? The perfectionist vibe, productivity. I'm trying to be efficient and maximize every day, all day. And so to me, that sounds really, really beautiful. So we actually talked about this topic a little bit before we went live. And we're kind of derailed from the questions that I originally asked, but honestly, that's okay, because this is such a great conversation. We talked about how all these different language and different technical stack communities vary in so many ways. And I fully agree. But I'd love to like kind of dive into that a bit, right? You just sort of shared with us what Ruby, the vibes you get from Ruby, which I'm going to go hang out with some Ruby devs. They sound like my people. But you know, a lot of what we get in sort of the JavaScript ecosystem is going to be more of, you know, it's just like younger, it's hipper. It's, I don't know. They're doing sort of different things. And I'd love to sort of talk through what you think you see and kind of cross that with maybe some of the things that I see, as we talk about different languages. So you had mentioned some of the other communities you're a part of. Do you want to start maybe sharing some of those and things you've witnessed?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I spent a huge chunk of my career in Java. I've spent a good chunk in .NET. I've done a lot of JavaScript. I mean, that's kind of almost in some ways the OG, right? I mean, that language goes back to the 90s. You know, and I worked at a Golang shop, Python. So, you know, I've kind of covered a lot of the usual suspects. JavaScript and TypeScript are both, you know, I think they're on such a tear in terms of popularity, in terms of usefulness, in terms of maturity. One of the things that I think is really, really cool over the last few years is JavaScript as a general purpose, especially backend, but even on the front end language, has really started maturing. I think the interesting thing is that JavaScript is still carrying and seems to be still struggling to figure out how to jettison the baggage of being a scripting language from the 90s.
Yeah.
And there's so much baggage that comes with this, all the transpiling, all of the, you know, memory issues, the way the event loop works is much, much better than it used to be. But, you know, async await and promises and things like that, that are, you know, concepts that, you know, I wasn't part of the working groups that developed those, but they feel to me very much like they were trying to, I don't want to say polish a turd, but in the sense like they were trying to take this language that was never designed to do what they wanted to do with it. But they, because of backward compatibility, because the runtimes are in every browser out there on every computer on the internet, and you can't just go magically snap your fingers and change all that, they had to have all of these backward compatibility features in the language. And so they've tried so hard to grow and develop and mature this language, while doing, you know, have their cake and eat it too. And it's really created a lot of complexity in that space. And then the other piece is the JavaScript as a community seems very, you know, a little bit, what's the word I'm looking for? I don't know.
I was trying to find the word too. It's hard.
Is fad driven, fashionable the right term? I'm not sure, but
trendy
front end frameworks. I'm so happy that React is finally kind of becoming almost a de facto standard, because for so long there, the front end frameworks didn't last a handful of years.
That's and so true.
Every code base, if you're thinking about it from a business perspective, technical debt is something every company has to deal with, but can you imagine building a product where in 2 years, you're almost guaranteed that all your front end code is obsolete just because JavaScripters decided that Moo wasn't cool anymore, right?
It's really true.
Really frustrating from a business perspective. Yep. So I'm really happy to see the TypeScript and JavaScript community, you know, finally getting to some level of maturity. There's still, I think, a ways to go to make it truly productive as it could be and as robust as it could be, but it's making a lot of really good strides. I've done a few JavaScript and TypeScript projects over the last 5 years that started feeling a lot better as an engineer, you know, sort of thing.
That's awesome. That's good to hear. How does that compare, obviously, to like .NET and Java, right? And then also, as you compare Java and .NET individually in themselves, like what differences do you see?
So Java, I think my experience there, because it's not used by a lot of startups, but I have worked with some larger companies over the last few years and gotten a little experience. I love what Java has been trying to fold in. More like historically, there was so much boilerplate. It was so, you know, highly structured. It was so, you know, earlier in the Java days, it was all about, we need to build the most capable mousetrap possible. And so everything was possible, which meant that you needed to know, you know, every possible, you know, configuration option in that, you know, JEE server configuration file and all of those. You had to weed through and create, you know, hundreds of lines of XML in order to get things to run at all. And, you know, so much boilerplate, and it was so painful. And I think over the years, they finally kind of started doing it. You get things like Spring Boot and things like that that are, I think, pulling a lot of great ideas from languages like JavaScript and Ruby and stuff like that. And .NET is very similar as well. What I love about what .NET's been doing lately is we're finally getting out of the world. Microsoft, I think, really suffered from coming up in a world where commercial software was all there was.
Yeah. Right?
Yep. And so for so long, the Microsoft community, the .NET community, like if it didn't come from Microsoft, or if you weren't paying tens of thousands of dollars a year for a license, then it was crap.
Yep.
And, you know, that has taken literally like a decade plus to evolve. But, you know, the current CEO of Microsoft is much more into the open source game. You got things like VS Code, which are pretty amazing. So I think that's all been shifting. You're starting to see more acknowledgement and widespread adoption of true open source projects in the .NET world. I've been talking with a company the past couple of weeks here that is a .NET startup. And so I'm kind of excited about getting my feet wet again in that world, because I'm a little bit rusty. But it's pretty, I think that's shifting quite a bit. It's really interesting. I've always loved Microsoft's developer tools. Their IDEs were fantastic. I started my career in Visual Basic, and I remember going to some of the earlier Java things like that. And I'd be like, well, where's the step through debugger? And everybody look at me like I had three heads. I mean, that's how far back this stuff goes, right? You know, and now it's like one of those things that nobody lives without. But yeah. Microsoft was doing that in C++ and VB way back.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So when I first started getting into coding, it was like back in like, oh, I want to say like 2007, at least professionally, right? I did it as a high schooler. I was building random stuff, trying to figure out how I can learn. I feel like a lot of us, right? And as nerds, we are always sort of diving into those types of things. But it's interesting when I first came into the ecosystem and have been working and like understanding, and I had a great conversation about this, is like understanding the system at which you're building with. And I think a long time ago, like earlier, like what you're referring to, right? I didn't quite hit it, but it's like in that sort of vein of earlier days of software development, it was just easier. It was easier, but it was harder, right? It was harder because you were building more. It was more complex. There was more things to manage, more things to think about. But at the same time, like I was... So this is going to like air my dev chops. The other day I was like, okay, I'm going to make a Next.js site. And I was like pulling stuff together. And I've been a leader for like 5 years and it hasn't been on a CTO level. So I haven't been necessarily in a whole lot of code. I've just been more in technological conversations. And I just like couldn't even troubleshoot stuff. And I'm like, just bring me back to my PHP stack where I'm like, I understand how SQL works. I understand how everything works. And like, I know my system. Where in these newer technologies, they're beautiful. It saves me so much time. I had a website up in hours, right? But then I also feel like I feel more imposter syndrome that I don't understand everything that's going on. And I think for me, it was just a great conversation. And you talking about all of this really sheds light on that too, of looking at sort of JavaScript compared to some of these other languages and how, you know, that just this lack of system understanding, I think is something that's a pain when you're looking in sort of the JavaScript ecosystems in comparison to others. I don't know if you feel or resonate with that, but.
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts, right? But like, there's so many pros and cons to the whole thing. So my degree is I called it technology and communication, as in I actually invented that title. I actually mashed up a computer science minor and a communications minor. Ooh. And because I was really interested. So, you know, we're in the Wayback Machine now, like, you know, Netscape was brand new, right? You know, the World Wide Web was something most people hadn't used yet, right? I'm old, but like I love the idea that technology serves a purpose to humanity. Like this is something that changes the way we live.
Yep.
Right. And like one of my absolute best friends in the entire world is the kind of guy who you can, you know. He likes, you know, shove him in a closet, give him a hard project. And once a month, you open the door, rainbows and unicorns come out, you shove in pizza and Mountain Dew, and you shut the door as quick as you can because, you know, he melts in sunlight, right? Like, he loves the tech for the tech. And yep. That is so cool, right? But that's not me. I'm more interested in, like, what did you do for people out here?
Yes.
Right? You need both of those, but like that's where I come from, is this sort of, and that's part of why I gravitate a lot to the business problem, is like, what are we trying to accomplish here? What are we really trying to do for people? And so to me, that's such a big piece of the whole puzzle that it kind of influences a lot of what I do with that. So when you start talking about kind of getting back to the question you really asked, like I don't technically have a computer science related degree. Mm-hmm. And that's useful. I use bits of that to frame like what's really going on under the covers. And I think that's helpful. And I think that the more that people learn about that stuff, the more it will help their career. It will help them with problem solving. It will help them think about problems in different ways that can be very useful. But on the flip side, like I am so excited about the idea that software engineering has really, at least as far as the stuff that I do, B2B SaaS, you know, stuff like that, it's much more like a trade than what I would call pure computer science, which is somebody working
yep.
in algorithms, like not just creating an LLM, but actually like doing the deep, you know, working for OpenAI or Google or something like that, right? That's computer science, right? Or designing processors or whatever, right? What I do is really to a trade. And so I love the idea that that's becoming more accessible. I love the idea that I can go hire a bootcamp grad, not because they're cheaper, but because they bring life experience from some place that isn't software. They've actually lived in the real world. And when you give them software chops, they are able to sort of synthesize those things. They're able to bring in, information about a problem domain, whether that's finance or customer, you know, dealing with customers or they were users of the software or whatever. They're not just somebody who's been writing code since they were 5 years old and that's all they do is they know the code. And I think that you need both, but you know, they're valuable. It's really interesting for a lot of business problems.
Yeah, I fully agree. Well, that's actually really, there's a lot of little nuggets you just dropped in there. Like a lot. That was really good.
The other before we get too far, the other thing I love about making it accessible is that it's bringing in not just a diversity of thought, but experience and you know, across all the vectors, right? People can get into this industry. I think, you know, obviously we're in an industry that is not particularly diverse and it's moving in the right direction. But I think making the languages, the frameworks, concepts like boot camps more accessible is a wonderful sort of shortcut or hack to adding diversity into the industry so that you don't have to. I mean, my, you know, 6-year-old girl is, I'm hoping, going to be a tech nerd when she grows up, but that's 15 years from now, right?
Yep.
Like that's a generational shift that takes a long time. But if we make the technology more accessible, then we can get there sooner.
Yep. I fully agree. I also fully agree with the ability of taking, you know, bringing someone in who's had a previous career. I came from hospitality and business management and in that side of things, right? So customer service was something I focused on heavily, right? So shifting into tech, I did it because I started having kids and I was like, okay, I need to learn to code. And I didn't want to be, you know, I started having kids very young. I was only 22. Anyways, and so I didn't want to be out late, right? And so I'm like, how do I learn a different career? I loved to code, loved to dive into things. And I really, truly am very thankful for the path that I took, even though I'm like, oh, I could have been a developer sooner. I could have gone to school for it. I could have gotten a comp sci degree. And I'm like, no, because I wouldn't understand and I wouldn't be as capable as I am now because I was the dev that was like, come into the client meetings, come talk to the client. They want this crazy technical thing. Can you talk them down, right? Talk to them about what they really need so we can actually come down to like, what are the features that truly need? And I think that's like, that's a magical skill that I didn't realize was magical. And I think that I encourage a lot of others to really try to expand on that, on the communications, on the ability to talk through those types of problems with non-nerds, even though we love talking to our nerds.
And it's impossible to be good at all the things, right?
Yep.
But that's why I love diverse teams too, is you've got the person who likes to be shut up in the closet, solve hard problems, right? And then you've got the person you can put in front of a customer and talk them off a ledge or put in front of the product owner and be like, you know, say in the nicest way possible that they're crazy, you know, that sort of thing, right? And
like, I would love that job.
Know, those are all skills, and but they all sort of revolve around this idea of code and building some software that's useful to somebody. But you need all of those things to have a truly successful team.
Yes, I agree. Okay, so we derailed from all of my questions, which is A-okay. I think I maybe asked you like, you know, the what's your job title, that one. One thing I am really curious, because you are a fractional CTO working in startups. So if anyone is looking, obviously, great person to reach out to. But I'm curious because two of the questions I ask, and they're more towards the end, and it's just to help devs understand where they should start going to find people like you or to find resources and learn what you've learned. So two questions. First one, where do you go when you're stuck, when you're personally stuck in something you can't solve technically or whatever it might be?
Yeah. So ultimately, I think you need an array of different options, right? Because a lot of times nothing, you know, one place doesn't work. And that's shifting obviously with AI and stuff like that. And so I usually try to get good at solving my own problems before I consume somebody else's time. So of course, you know, you're Googling, your Stack Overflow, your GitHub, you know, issues, you're looking for those sorts of things. Now you can throw Copilot, other AI, things like that. And I'm starting to use those more. And I think they're becoming useful. You know, I don't think we're at the, you know, the holy grail yet. I don't think our jobs are quite in danger yet. But that not might yet. Happen. But honestly, you've got to build networks too. You know, if you've got colleagues you're working with, obviously that's your first stop. That's the best place. You know, I've been doing this for 25 years and yesterday I had to, you know, ask my fellow coder, like, help me. I am so stuck, you know, and, you know, pairing up when you need to is just a magical thing. You know, and you have to sort of get over your own ego, right?
Yep.
When it comes to code reviews, when it comes to pairing up, you have to be able to say, I don't know, I'm stuck. And, you know, can I learn something from somebody else? And then obviously, if you're in a super hyper small company where you don't have like a panorama of people that you can talk to, then you got to find another community, right? And so there's some great Slack communities out there. I imagine I'm not on any of them, but I imagine there's some great Discords and things like that out there for people in whatever stack that you're playing with, you know, that sort of stuff. But you know, I think that's you got to find ways to solve your problems, right? And that's what this is all about. And you know, figuring out how to connect with people that have similar problems is just the way that we support each other.
I agree. Build your nerd herd around you, right? Who are you going to go to? Mm-hmm. Okay. So very similar question, somewhat different though. So if you are looking for, let's say you need a new tool or a new solution, or you're building something and you're just like, hey, I know that, you know, maybe you're going to integrate something, you're going to bring something else in. How do you start to search for those things? Like, you know, maybe I'm going to leave it at that. Where would you go to go look for something like that? Similar question, but.
That's a tough one for me personally, because I'm usually the one who's, you know, especially in a fractional CTO role, I'm usually not absolutely the most technical person in the room, right? There's almost always somebody else in the room who has ideas for how to solve mm-hmm. the problem, right? And so whether that's a particular, you know, SaaS tool or a dev tool or something like that, it's usually not me. And I'm totally cool with that. And I tend to jump around frameworks and languages and stuff enough that I'm not deep enough in any one of them at any given time, to be the one with those answers. And so again, I'm using that same community. I'm still, you know, either talking with the people on my team, or I'm talking with, you know, I'm looking around at I've got some Slack channels that I'm part of and things like that, where I'm always, you know, hearing about new things. And I try and pay attention, but there's so much going on out there right now. It's pretty cool.
Tell me about it. Yeah. Tell me about it.
It's really cool.
I've been trying to stay up to date, and like, at least, you know, with it being like my role, right, is like, I do competitive analysis and market insights and, you know, developer experience audits of my clients, but then I also compare and contrast them to their competitors. Where do you have that edge? Where do they not? And so I've just been trying to be like, okay, let me just do market research, like just chip away at it every day. And I'm like, oh my gosh, the number of tools that are coming out. I'm like, I'm just going to have to stay with like knowing the hip ones and hope that the new ones just come in as clients so I can learn them that way. Yeah. Good follow-up question to what you shared, and I think would be very insightful for our users and anyone listening. You being in the CTO role, I expected that kind of an answer, right? Because oftentimes it's the users, the developers, the ones who are going to be in that tool that want to advocate that up to their leadership and say, hey, we need this. So what are some of the things that, you know, if a developer on your team really wants to use a tool, like how can they come at you with the strongest argument or sort of representation for you to be like, okay, let's try it.
Bring data, bring a story, right?
Love it.
You know, and data isn't always possible, but can you tell a compelling story about it, about how this is going to make our life better? What problem is it solving? My favorite environment in terms of the question you're asking was a company where they had a really, really amazing, it was a little bit larger company. They had a really, really amazing infrastructure engineering and SRE team. Mm-hmm. And it was as a leader there, it made it super easy for me, because we could literally have a policy that said any team, I think we had, I don't know, 8 or 10 teams. It was a little bit larger company. Anybody can do anything they want. If your team, you know, wants to go do X stack or language or whatever, you're empowered to do that. However, we have kind of our official, you know, stack, and that if you use that stack, it comes with the observability, the alerting, the monitor, the canary deploys, all of the different things, the backups, the disaster recovery, the auditing, all of those things, right? So if you want to diverge from our core stack, you go for it. But you need to solve for all of those requirements There were cases where people did, and it was good because they had a strong need for, because of this other problem, this stack was not a great fit. And so they solved for that, and that became another stack that we could support. But it sort of weeded out that because I think it's cool sort of thing, and brought it a business perspective of, okay, what's the problem I'm trying to solve? And is this the right solution? And this is a case where it's a little bit more of a mature company. Okay. So not always applicable to startups, but I think it provides one healthy way to approach that problem, right? Where we could literally say, if you've got a good idea, let's talk about it, right? Maybe it does solve a great problem and we're empowered to go do that. You don't even have to ask for permission, right? But you have to solve for these requirements for the business and sustainability, right? And a lot of times that, you know, if it was sort of a casual, I think Rust is a really cool language, you know, okay, fine. But, you know, if you don't solve for all these other things, you'd be like, ah, yeah, I think I'm just going to stick with what we got, you know? And I don't like, you know, having people sort of resign to that, like, oh, I guess it's not worth it, whatever. That's not what I'm going for. But what I'm saying is that it opened the possibility to make a business case that we would, go forward with. Right. And it's okay.
Yeah. And it's okay if they decide not to, because they've gone through that checklist and they're like, I don't need it this bad, or I don't want it this bad, or it isn't, I don't need to chase down all these other things, right? It isn't necessarily that you're saying, oh, good, you gave up, right? It's more of like, no, you did what you needed to do. Is the problem worth solving and solving all of these different areas, or can you solve it in a different way?
It put a more objective lens on it, right? Yeah. And it allowed you to really evaluate the, you know, whatever ROI or whatever you, whatever terms you want to use there. Right. But you know, you can get to a point where you're really talking about, is it worth it? Is it valuable? Is it something we need? And there were cases where it was, right. You know, the analytics team, you know, wanted to use Python, and that wasn't part of our core stack. But that's a crazy, crazy powerful language and stack for analytics. Right.
Absolutely.
So it made sense, and they did the work, and it was great. Right.
I love that. I think that's a beautiful blend of like sort of both ends of the spectrum, right? Of just saying yes to all the things and ending up with technology you're trying to update, like we talked about, right? JavaScript frameworks changing every few years, not too long ago.
Right.
So I think it's a beautiful answer to that versus like, go do what you want, right? It's not the wild, wild west. We've got some what's the things in bowling? The gutters. Are they things they put? Is that what they call them? Yeah, like those little bouncy things. Anyway, I was trying to say that smoothly and eloquently, and it didn't come.
The kids use, right?
Yes. I can't think of them. Either way, we know we're envisioning it. You're stuck in a lane. You can do what you want in your lane, but you can't leave that lane, which I think is a really safe.
Leave the lane if you can do it in a way that's, you know, that meets the objectives, that meets the requirements, right?
Yes, exactly. Okay, I could honestly talk to you for like hours. You are so interesting to talk to. Maybe because you're a fellow Minnesotan, you know, so we've got that Minnesota vibe going on.
Got that connection.
Yeah. Where can people find you? Because I think they're going to be intrigued by a lot of what you're sharing. And I think obviously you have this beautiful opportunity where you do fractional CTO and there might be folks looking for your services. So where can folks find you?
Yeah, I need to do some work on my marketing materials, honestly.
I can help you.
The best place to go.
So
Neil Tobson, /in/Neil Tobson. That's probably the best place for now. And I'm working on getting better at the marketing stuff.
I literally do marketing for my dev tool clients, and my own marketing is complete trash. So
I know your website looks pretty good.
It's a work in progress. All right. Well, this has been absolutely lovely. So great hearing from you, and so awesome to hear about your journey and everything that you've shared. And I hope that you have a fabulous rest of your day. Give Minnesota a big hug for me.
Will do. Will do. Big cold hug.
Yeah. Cold hug. We need those hugs there, right? It's chilly.
Awesome. Thank you.
All right. Yes. Thank you.